The first case on this afternoon's docket is U.S. Bank National v. Pamia Development Company, case 62112. Mr. Henry, there you go.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, excerpt for rebuttal. May it please the Court, Joel Henriot on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Midland Loan Services. I know the Court has read all of the briefing, so when it comes to giving a nutshell, I'll be brief. This is an appeal from a summary judgment order that dismissed plaintiff's claim to a deficiency following a sale by a receiver. In granting the summary judgment, we submit that the District Court misapplied two technicalities that it drew from two statutory schemes that do not apply to receivership sales. And as the Court reviews this case de novo, we would point out a few errors that the Court should consider. First, as a threshold matter, the statutory schemes that the District Court relied upon, Chapter 40 and judicial foreclosures under Chapter 40, as well as reference to trustee sales under Chapter 107, don't apply by their express terms to receiver sales. In Chapter 40, you see beginning at the statutory scheme in Section 40 point, or NRS 40.430, you see a description of the type of sale that is contemplated in subsection 4, where it refers to the manner in which sales are executed in Section 21.
Why is this not a foreclosure, not considered a foreclosure sale? There's also some degree of difficulty because what was asserted by the bank in some of their moving papers initially, mm-hmm. and how they brought this, and the Court deemed some of that as admissions by the party as to what was appropriate.
On the first question, I think that there is some confusion as to the meaning of foreclosure sale. I think that there are two definitions at issue and there was confusion. The first, if you take a look at foreclosure broadly defined as any action by a lender to seize upon security, to liquidate it for purposes of applying against a loan, then yes, it was a foreclosure in that sense because that's what Midland was attempting to do. But the confusion is caused because in Chapter 40, foreclosure sale is used with a much more particular meaning. And the particular meaning in Chapter 40...
Mr. Henry, before we break down,
right.
before we get into the debate okay. about whether the deficiency statutes apply or not, the threshold question is to characterize this sale. Mm-hmm. Is a sale by a receiver a judicial foreclosure? It certainly doesn't appear to be a non-judicial foreclosure. So would you concede that it's a judicial foreclosure? You've argued that a receiver sale is different, but there seems to be some jurisprudence that says a court-supervised sale, which I think by any account, mm-hmm. the court's authorization of the disposition of real property sold through the receiver process looks to me like a judicial foreclosure.
Right, and foreclosure broadly defined, I would say yes.
Let's just say judicial sale so you don't get hung up on that.
Right, thank you.
And, it's a judicial
and
sale.
I think that the distinction is important because in Chapter 40, foreclosure sale in that context refers to a public option. And that's actually a distinction that on appeal...
It's a separate issue, which the district court didn't address. But my question is this. If you characterize the sale as a judicial sale, then the question is, and if you then say it's a judicial foreclosure sale, in the true sense of a judicial foreclosure sale, do the deficiency statutes apply to a judicial foreclosure sale? We have these as opposed to a non-judicial foreclosure sale.
So I think the problem there is that the statute, Chapter 40, which seems to govern judicial foreclosure sales as opposed to non-judicial foreclosure sales in 107080, is that it discusses a form of foreclosure sale. And the reason that I say form is that the form of the sale is important because it seems to govern the scope of the statute. Not every judicial foreclosure in the broad sense that we're talking about it, I believe we're talking about it now under your question, is included in Chapter 40, because under Chapter 40, it defines the type of sale much more narrowly to be a public auction, a judicially supervised public auction by the county sheriff. And that's why I think it does not apply under Chapter 40, because it's not a public auction. It is not a trustee auction. And Chapter 40 is not clear that it applies to any type of foreclosure procedure outside of the auction area. And that seemed to be Judge Tao's reasoning, is that any foreclosure taking place in the under the auspices of the court, whether by a receiver or by a sheriff at auction, falls under Chapter 40. Chapter 40 doesn't say that. I suppose the legislature could make the election to include receiverships as falling also under the rubric of judicial foreclosure, but it doesn't say that it does.
But if the, it's my understanding that the debtor and guarantor in this case did not request a public auction, or did not oppose the sale anyway, the sale motion by the receiver, is that correct?
That's true in part. When we initially moved for the appointment of a receiver, then Paul Miller Development Company Mr. Rappaport, as the 100% owner of Paul Miller, did oppose the appointment of a receiver. And their position at that time was that we had nearly perfected all that we needed to do to follow, to use a non-judicial foreclosure, that we could go with a trustee sale, that we were only 21 days away from doing that, and that we ought to just proceed on that basis. Now, the district court Judge Togliatti did find that there was a good basis, to use a receiver sale here, because selling this at a fire sale price on the courthouse steps did not make much sense when it came to a property this complex with 160 units, almost all of them with their own parcel numbers. It was a complex transaction, and she agreed that the best way to maximize the recovery in price and minimize the amount of the deficiency was to sell this property on the private market the way that any seller normally would. And that is the way that it went. The problem with a public auction would be, and the reason that I go into this is because now on appeal, a defendant, Paul Miller and Mr. Rappaport, take the interpretation of Chapter 40 one step further than the district court did. What the district court said was, if you're going to have a receiver sale, it would fall within the rubric of some judicial foreclosure, and so would have to comply with Chapter 40. But he wasn't saying, as I read his order, that a receivership necessarily cannot be used for judicial foreclosure.
Counselor, I understand the argument you're making. What I'm troubled with is that your client, up to a certain point, got exactly what they, in fact, asked the court for. This was done by your client at their request. The court granted their various motions to do what they did. So now we have kind of a change in position based upon the ultimate outcome, but not what was originally asked for. That's kind of difficult to reconcile. Why is the original position juxtaposed the present position? Well, from your standpoint, it's not. So.
I don't think that we asked for any benefit that we received and are now changing position. I think that there was frustrating difficulty in the original form of the complaints, which we amended. I think, for instance, that terms were used perhaps too imprecisely in pleadings that we then withdrew before there was a determination on them. But what we asked for all along was a receiver to conduct a private sale so that, given the complexity of the project, we could maximize recovery and minimize the deficiency. And there was no question that we would seek a deficiency after that sale was completed. The fact that there was a difference in the terminology used in the first amended complaint versus the second amended complaint, I don't think is a contradiction in the way that we have actually litigated the case or the relief that we have asked for. It really is a simple approach that has not changed. We wanted a receiver to sell this property to get the most out of it, and then we wanted to pursue the deficiency. Now, if I'll go ahead and jump quickly because I understand that the court understands our position on whether or not the statutory schemes apply, and we submit they don't. But and I would add to that, there's no reason to suppose that the legislature meant to exclude receiverships from the statutory scheme, to say that the only way to make yourself eligible for a deficiency is by auctioning the property under Chapter 40 or 107. I think the reason for that is because so often, given the complexity of a project, you will grossly diminish the amount that is actually received if you are complying only with the auction standards under Chapter 40. You advertise that property by posting posters three spots around town and running an ad in the RJ for 3 weeks in a row. Where here what we did is we went to a reputable realty company. They posted the notice on three realty sites. They targeted, identified, and called 1,000 potential buyers across the country, investors that would be interested in this type of project.
But Mr. Henry, I'm not sure that, and I'd like to hear from the other side about this, I'm not sure that whether the sale was conducted privately by this receiver or whether it was a public auction is relevant for purposes of determining deficiency, because the measure of deficiency is based on fair market value.
And here the district court made an express determination of fair market value when we moved to approve the terms of the sale, and Mr. Rappaport through Palmilla did not object to that. Let me jump real quick to the other reasons for why the district court granted summary judgment. One was the timing. The court found that we filed the deficiency action too late, more than 6 months after the district court had approved the sale. But approval of the sale is not a correct determination of the date of sale, for the simple reason that there is a big difference between an agreement to buy something and actually buying something. I think that oft times with an auction, you don't see a problem in determining what the date of the sale is, because when you buy something on the courthouse steps, you have to bring the cash with you. You pay in full. You pay immediately. The sheriff requires payment within 24 hours. As opposed to a private sale that takes time to close through escrow. You have contingencies. You have to do appraisals. You have to do inspections. You have to satisfy all the requirements of the lender. Here, there was a lender backing the buyer to the point of $6.25 million. It came with all of the complications in closing escrow that any of us face, even when we buy a home. And to say that the property was sold before there was ever a transaction of dollars for real estate, I think turns the definition of sale date on its head. Because all you had before then was an agreement to purchase. You didn't have an actual purchase. And here, we filed within 6 months of the close of escrow. There's a straw man here that there's an allegation that we are arguing that the 6 months should run from the date of the recordation of the deed. That is not our contention. What we're saying is that the date of sale is the date that escrow closes. Escrow closed on June 7th. That was in the record before the
court. If we equate this to a foreclosure sale, it would square up our jurisprudence with Sandpoint.
You could do that, although in Sandpoint, that was an auction sale. In Sandpoint, there is a discussion distinguishing between the date of sale and between the, the judgment granting the deficiency, but Sandpoint did not discuss how you define the date of sale in and of itself. I think I'll reserve that.
All right.
Good afternoon, court and counsel, please. I'm Brett Larson, attorney for the respondents. I'd like to start with the argument that what the appellant is trying to accomplish is something that they should take at the legislative level, not the judicial level. They argue in their briefs that their obligation starts with a note and deed of trust, and we agree with that. But what they miss in that statement is that the note and deed of trust are regulated by statute, just as the UCC regulates contracts, just as the insurance code regulates contracts. This is a contract regulated by statute. The statutes clearly set out the procedure for accomplishing a deficiency judgment. To say that because they had a receiver sale rather than a foreclosure sale takes them out of the purview.
I think we need to be more precise. I don't mean to be critical or sound that way, but to me we need to be more precise. Is this a judicial foreclosure, or it's certainly not a non-judicial foreclosure? So is this a judicial foreclosure?
I want to answer the question this way. Chapter 40 speaks of foreclosures either being a judgment creditor — they never became a judgment creditor — or a beneficiary of a deed of trust. In other words, you have a trustee sale under 107, or you have a judgment creditor sale under Chapter 21 that's initiated through 40.430. So this is not a judicial foreclosure because they never became a judgment creditor. And it's important to keep in mind that they gloss over, and Your Honor made a comment that the guarantor never objected to this sale. Let's not forget that twice they sued Mr. Rappaport for a deficiency, and they dismissed him from those cases. They dismissed the cases. They then bring the third case, and while all of this receivership proceedings are taking place, they make the choice that Mr. Rappaport doesn't need to be a party to these proceedings. So to say that he didn't object when he's not a party, he doesn't have standing to object. So when we analyze this in terms of the deficiency protections guaranteed by Chapter 40 to borrowers and guarantors, those are defenses that belong to my client. A lender cannot unilaterally develop a new procedure to take away the defenses that the legislature has granted to borrowers and guarantors. Now, Judge Tao pointed out, when he granted summary judgment, that if you allow lenders to utilize this procedure, then the courthouse is going to be swamped with cases, because henceforth, all lenders will have to do is bypass Chapter 40, bypass 107, and just do their own receivership sales, and then close escrow when they feel like it, and make those guarantors and borrowers in suspense indefinitely as to what their liability will be. The point of our anti-deficiency statutes is to send a message to lenders, borrowers, and guarantors that from the date of the sale, you have 6 months to bring a suit. Now, we say that there was no foreclosure sale, therefore they failed to comply with the Kieber case. When we argued before Judge Tao, that was our first line of defense. Judge Tao took a pass on analyzing that, and then went to the statute of limitations and the notice issues. But the Keeter case, that issue is very real in this case. And as the court said in the SFR case, and I know there's concurring dissenting opinions, but what I believe everyone agreed with was Justice Pickering's statement that in Nevada we have to have uniform consistency of the laws in order to be able to be commercially reasonable and do business here. So, in applying this consistency, I want to make this point. And you've asked, why no objection to the sale by the borrower who only had standing? And the answer is this. When you're advising a client as to how to proceed, and the lender says, we've got 31 potential buyers here, and we've got people offering more money than this $9.5 million sale price, but we want to seal this bid, which they eventually withdrew. But they clearly made it known that there were other buyers waiting in the wings, and we want to do a private sale. Then, as an attorney, you read the Keeber case, you try to properly advise your client, you try to stay consistent within the law, and you're going to come to the conclusion that if they choose to avoid the public auction, as criticized by what the lender did in Keeber, identical situation, if they're going to avoid that, that's fine. Let them sell for whatever price they choose to accept. But they close the door on themselves from thereafter pursuing a deficiency. So my point is, because they're a beneficiary of a deed of trust, they're regulated by the anti-deficiency statutes. Therefore, while they were not contesting the sale, for them to procedurally make themselves eligible for a deficiency, they first had to do a foreclosure sale. Now, since they didn't do that, then we come to the next argument. Even if they get past that hurdle, which we submit is a hurdle they can't overcome, then did they file suit within the six-month period? The Lavin case, even the dissenting opinions, I think we've recognized, that you can't change the rules. The point in Lavin was a lender can't change the rule by filing their deficiency before the foreclosure. They have to wait until after. In this case, there was, unlike Lavin, the errant lender in Lavin, there wasn't even an effort within the six-month period following Judge Todd Liotti's order to bring a claim for a deficiency judgment. So we're saying if you're treating this sale by Judge Todd Liotti as a, quote, judicial sale or a trustee sale, then they still have to file suit within 6 months. That's the same thing that saved the lender in Walters, is at least they did something within that six-month period of the sale to satisfy the claim for deficiency. Here, appellant did nothing in that six-month period. Now, then the question is,
there's a, depending upon what date the sale date is determined to be, wasn't the third amended complaint filed within the 6 months from the date they argue?
No. It wasn't from the date they argue? No.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, let me mischaracterize. We have an original complaint that makes no claim for a deficiency.
Okay.
All right. Then they file a first amended complaint. The counsel said there was a difference between the first and second. The only difference is they misnamed the plaintiff in the first amended complaint. When it was brought to their attention, by the time they filed the second amended complaint, that was in the spring, I don't forget the exact date, but that's in the spring of 2011. Their sale, they say, closed on June 7th, 2010. So the second amended complaint is far beyond even their period. But Your Honor made the point, how do we square our jurisprudence with Sandpoint? Sandpoint says the 6 months runs from the date of the trustee sale or judgment creditor sale. Now, their argument confuses the difference between a sale date and a closing date. But our statutes make it clear to ascertain when the sale date is, because this case, if it's published, would affect even non-judicial sales. Well, what is the sale date? The only case cited on this point is on all fours with our position that it says it runs from the date the hammer falls. That's in the PACCAR case. But in Nevada, Our statutory provisions also supply that answer. Because the sale date, to have a sale date, you have to publish a notice of sale. Whether you're going under Chapter 21 for a judgment creditor, I believe that's NRS 21-130, or if you're going under Chapter 107 on a trustee sale. In either case, you publish a date for a notice of sale. And that, then, when the sale occurs on the date that is published, or continued by oral proclamation, if that was the case, which never occurred here, that establishes the sale date. Our own statutes recognize the difference between the sheriff's sale date or the trustee's sale date and the date payment is made. Because the statutes allow for 1 month to say that the sheriff would require cash. There's no statutory requirement for that. The statute gives a month to get the deed recorded. So the statutes in and of themselves recognize we have a sale date for purposes of determining when the foreclosure sale date starts, when the statute of limitations clock starts running, and then we have a closing date, which could occur at a later point in time.
Now, when was Mr. Rappaport added back to the case or added to the case? Was it in the Third Amended complaint?
It was in the First Amended complaint. There is no Third Amended complaint.
Okay.
It was the First Amendment complaint when it was brought in for the first time in November of 2010, late November, November 24th, which was 8 months after Judge Togliatti's sale.
Okay.
Now, one other final point I'd like to make. The appellant has argued that this is a better way to achieve fair market value. First of all, that argument should be rejected for three reasons. The argument was never made in the court below that they're now making. It's made for the first time on appeal. To say that receivers do better than auctions was made for the first time here in this court. Second of all, there's nothing in the record to support that claim. That would be an issue of fact that would require expert testimony, perhaps, to say that the way they market it gets a better price than the way that it could have received if auctioned. And most importantly, third reason is, that's an argument that they need to take to the legislative arena. If they think that debtors, borrowers are better protected by the procedure they chose, then that's an argument to take to the legislature to get them to change the statutes. But the legislature has determined that because real property is unique, the best way to protect the debtor is to have a public auction. And Justice Hardesty, you made the comment that we're only deducting fair market value. That's not quite the case. The statute says the debtor and guarantor get the benefit of the higher number of either the bid price or fair market value. And in this case, we had a perfect opportunity to have an auction, invite everybody to participate, and they chose not to do that. And maybe in an auction, people are oftentimes willing to pay more than fair market value. An example of that is what we see in our probate courts. Appellant argues, well, let's let this favor this one buyer. He spent all this money on due diligence. So let's protect him. Let's forget about what's the best price. Let's protect him. They had a shared attorney. The attorney represented, represented the bank, represented the receiver. But when they went for this confirmation, if they've done like a probate court did, or does, you can have very spirited bidding. If they had put this sale up for auction in the probate court, they could have accomplished the spirit of our statutes. But they instead chose to go with this private sale. So I again come back to the point. If we're going to properly advise our clients, and you see a lender purposely evade the very protections that are provided in the anti-deficiency statutes, you don't oppose that sale. You let them make their mistakes. In our adversarial system of justice, it's not my job to say, oh, by the way, you're out of bounds. Let me coach you on how to get back on the playing field to really go after my client for a deficiency. Of course, we're not going to do that. That's why the sale was never opposed, because they never once started to comply with the statutes. And so we submit that Judge Tao's order is well-reasoned. He clearly identifies all the mistakes they made. It isn't just a matter of poor wording in their pleadings. They filed this as a deficiency. And to use a colloquial term, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's got to be a duck. They chose to bypass other potential bidders. They chilled the bids in the process. That's it's undisputed on the record. And so this judgment in my client's favor, we believe, should be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay. I'll give you 1 minute, Mr. Henry. You'd expired your time, but go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I was confused. The clock is not working up here. Real quick, the first amended complaint named Mr. Rappaport. It sought a deficiency. The second amended complaint did nothing more than cure a clerical error in the allegations. The plaintiff is named as the incorrect bank, but the caption is correct. There is no substantive difference, and that first amended complaint was 6 months after the date that the sale closed. Defendant says that he wasn't a party, that he didn't have notice. This is not just a case of actual knowledge of the proceedings going on. Here you have actual participation. At that hearing, where the district court granted a receiver because the district court deemed that it was the most reasonable way to increase the receipts from the sale, Mr. Rappaport was sitting at defense table. So, yes, there was an opportunity to participate. There was actual knowledge, and the requirement for actual knowledge, or even for the...
Finish your thought.
The notice provision that's being relied upon is under 107. And under 107, that's a non-judicial foreclosure sale, which means no one is a party anyway. That requirement is not about making someone a party. It is about letting them know that the procedure is going on. Here you have actual notice. Thank you.
Okay, counsel, thank you very much for your input here today. We appreciate your briefing and your arguments, and the case will stand submitted.